Accession number 27058, Reel 10.
On going to Yugoslavia, what was your understanding of the political situation at the time, apart from the fact that there was a war going on?
I don't think any of us had much of an understanding of what was going on. We knew that there were these four groups of people going around. We knew that at the moment Marshal Tito was in charge of everything. We knew Dragolje Mihajlović was his rival, and Mihajlović wanted to be the leader, and Tito didn't want Dragolje to be the leader. And we heard from other people that this groups of Ustasi and groups of Germans were everywhere. I don't think anybody had a clear picture of what was going on, except it was highly confused. We knew that what we were there for was to help the partisans get rid of the Germans. But when I got back, the AOC came to see me, and he said, oh, this was the 18th of September 1944. This was the second time I'd been shot down. And Air Vice Marshal Elliot came to see me and said, Robert, you are now Tour X. And Tour X means tour expired. When you go to any squadron, there's a predetermined number of flights or missions which are regarded as a tour. On 6th Squadron, because of the hazardous nature of the operations, 6th Squadron was a volunteer squadron. They never posted anybody there, only volunteers. But although it was a risky job in many ways, we were never short of volunteers. And I said, well, sir, I'm quite happy to continue flying. At the time, I was going out with a very beautiful person on the right-hand side who was based in Bari, which is in that part of Italy. Her name is Patty King. And Patty and I were going out, we were quite seriously with each other. And I was having the time of my life. I was the flight commander, had my own aeroplane, had my own jeep, had a couple of Italian POWs to look after my personal comfort and keep everything washed and tuned, screened and so on. And I was quite happy to keep on flying. And he said, ah, you're worse than I thought, hearing troubles as well. I'm almost certain I just told you Tour X. That is it. But here's the good news. We can put the shutters up a bit early and you can buy me one or two nice drinks. But what they did, knowing that I was going out with young Miss Ching, they kept me on the squadron under false pretenses for a few weeks, pretending I was doing something frightfully important, which I wasn't. I was seeing a lot of my little girlfriend. And finally, John Curtin at that stage had made a big decision. He was the Prime Minister of Australia, so he made a big decision, which was echoed around the world, that all Australians would be sent home immediately. I think the aim was to get them up the islands and fight the Japs, because that was becoming a bit of a problem. So they got a signal that flying Oscar Ulrich had better be on the next ship from Naples, or there will be questions asked at higher administration level. So they said, sorry, Robert, did what we could for you, can't do any more. No, it didn't really matter then, because Patty had just been sent to London. And I went to see the group captain. I think his name was Glass or Class. He was actually one of the pilots of the Battle of Britain. There's a lot of confusion about Battle of Britain. A lot of people think that anybody in the Air Force or the RAF was automatically a pilot in the Battle of Britain, which is certainly not true. There are only about four or five squadrons, I think. I can't remember their numbers. But the grouper said, well, I said, well, yeah, my little girlfriend has been pushed off to England, and now that I'm sort of an underemployed pilot, I wouldn't mind if somebody could find me a place in London. He said, Robert, I'll do it for you. I've seen your girlfriend. She's a very lovely girl. I will organise it for you. I said, good, thank you, sir. Bust off. About 3 days later, I got a message, please go and see the group captain. So I went down to see him and said, Robert, I've got some very bad news. I can't do a thing for you, because the war is now coming to an end, and all the training establishments all over the world are either closing down or they've closed down. The only place I could have sent you, he rattled off a few names, is at training establishments where you could have gone as an instructor, but they're all closing or they're closed, so there's not a thing I could do. If there was, I'd help you. But sorry, can't help, can't do a thing for you. Thank you, sir, for anyone trying. So they took me back to Egypt, put me in a transit camp called Kasserit, which is on the shores of the Great Bitter Lake, and in due course, the Strathnailer, then a trip ship, steamed in, and all of us who were selected to come back to Australia went down, got on the Strathnailer, and home we came.
Before we go
yep.
home,
yep.
I'm interested, you mentioned Marshal Tito. Yep. I understand you actually met him.
Briefly, a few seconds. Can you switch that off? I'll go and get a little something and show you.
Okay, you mentioned that Marshal Tito was going to come and see you. What do you have in your hand here?
Well, the campaign ribbons that I was given after the war, and that's the DFC. Mm-hmm. That's the Caterpillar badge, which they give you when you are required to use a parachute to save your life.
Sorry, you were talking about your Caterpillar badge.
Yeah, well, that's the Caterpillar badge which they give you when you have to use a parachute to save your life, resulting from action by the enemy. It's a form of advertising because a lot of pilots or aircrew have great reluctance to accept the fact that these safety equipment items, a parachute is one, the Mae West is another, and an RFD is another, won't work properly at the time. And of course, if you see blokes walking around with that, you know, well, that bloke's parachute works, so why shouldn't mine work? That's the goldfish badge. That's when you've got to use a rubberized dinghy first. That's a bar to the goldfish badge, which you do it a second time. And that was the little identification disc given to us by Marshal Tito. Well, it was neat and clean. It was very, very bright red. And some young Padazanka had stitched in a hammer and sickle with bright yellow cotton. And that's the RAFAS badge, the RA, the Royal Air Forces Escaping Society. So Tito just came. He was there and gone in 20 minutes. But none of the AOC didn't like him. The group captain didn't like him, and our CO didn't like him. He was probably a bit bumptious, I think. And I did hear that if Tito didn't like you, you had a bit of a habit of suddenly seeming to vanish a bit. It was very wise not to upset Marshal Tito.
Vanish a bit, vanish forever.
Well, more often than not, I would think, yeah. He had a little island called Brioni, which is up to the northeast of the Dalmatian archipelago. Without knowing it was his little hideaway, I flew over it one day, not realising that anybody of importance was there. And when I got back, the CO said, you're a bloody idiot, you flew over Brioni. And I said, well, I wasn't going to run carrying a bloody hurricane. He said, that's where Marshal Tito's got his little camp. I said, I didn't see any bloody signs. He said, don't fly over Brioni, you bloody clot. Okay, so they put a big red ring on our operation map in Brioni. And a red ring meant no fly area. But someone told me one day that Marshal Tito designed all his own uniforms. I believe he had more than 400 uniforms. He looked like something out of Meyer's Christmas window when he came to see us. Very, very dapper, very neat. He wasn't a very big fellow, about 5'8 or 5'9. He was pretty chunky. But the thing I remember most about him, I saw this in Perth, when the first Woolworths store opened in Hay Street. In those days, Woolworths' motto was, nothing over 2 and 6 pence. And I was having a browse through what was available in the merchandise list one day, and they had a funny little thing shaped like a tobacco pipe, but it had a very small hole in the bowl of the pipe. And someone said, well, that's a cigarette pipe. And I said, what's a cigarette pipe? They said, well, you put the cigarette in there and use it. And I said, I think they're about a shilling. And Tito had one of those, and I never saw him smoke a cigarette other than this little bloody cigarette pipe.
Did he say anything to you?
I think he probably said good luck or thank you or something like that. But he asked us to make sure and carry that. if the partisans got you, and you could show them one of those, they wouldn't ask any further questions. They would do whatever they could to save you. I think all he said was, good luck, or thank you very much, or something like that. He gave one of those to all the pilots on the squadron.
You mentioned also, off-air once, a form that you were given that you could show people if you were to ditch or be picked up.
Yeah, it's called a blood jet. And the first time I was shot down, I finished up... Oh, I can't quite remember. Oh, I think it was the island of Rab. And they were going to give me... allow me to travel with a group of partisans as far south as they could, and then they were going to make some arrangement for a ship to pick me up. And they give you this little, right, you see it? Blood sheet?
No,
and all it is, it's a very ordinary piece of butcher paper with a typed message and a very official stamp on the bottom. And it said, this English pilot has fallen from the sky with his aeroplane. Please look after him and see he gets to so and so to take passage on the ship. So they gave you that, so you put it in your pocket. And travelling at night, there are no signs and there are no lights anyway. So it's pretty sort of harrowing trying to, because they try and move as quickly as possible, because the less time they're on the track, the less chance they had of getting caught. But if you missed your, or somehow misplaced the partisan group you were with, or got parted in any way, and somebody else picked you up, if it was another partisan person or partisan group, show them that and the bloodshed, and they knew you were a bona fide helper of Yugoslavs. And they had a saying in Yugoslavia which was daubed over walls, and the saying was, fighting for the liberation of Yugoslavia. That was a very common phrase. And if they thought that you fell into that category, there's not a thing they wouldn't do for you.
A dangerous job, though, given the situation.
Oh, yeah, probably. Well, I mean, Yugoslavia was a fairly dangerous place. It was full of bloody Germans and Mustachi. But that's what you expect if you join the Air Force as a pilot, and you suddenly find yourself sent overseas to harass the Germans, as the Americans say, and that goes with the territory.
But in relation to the job of being a partisan, a dangerous job to be in.
Obviously. Oh, very that. Yes, if they were captured by the Germans, they were very badly treated. But there was a second saying they had in Yugoslavia, which sounded a bit earthy at the moment. Now it might be slightly bizarre or slightly... out of touch with the saying was, and boy, this meant something. The saying was that if a German was captured by the partisans, if he was real lucky, he was already dead. If he wasn't dead, just hang around for a minute or two and that'll be throughput right. They were very savage with the Germans. Well, they didn't want the Germans there. Of course, when the Germans came down in 1941, as far as I can remember, the Germans walked into Yugoslavia from Hungary. I think it was early in April 1941. And when they went down, all the way down the Balkan Peninsula, they had Hungary on their left side, Romania and Bulgaria, and they had Yugoslavia and Albania, and then Greece at the bottom. And they raped and murdered and pillaged and did all sorts of barbaric things. But on the way back, things were a little different. They didn't have any fuel, so they couldn't use any motorised vehicles or machines to help them. And a British officer told me one day that it was considered that about 1 million Germans left Greece and went north to Austria. And he said, as far as I know, only about one third got back, the rest were killed on the way, because they were slaughtered by Bulgaria, Romania and Hungary, and they had the Greeks behind them. The Greeks underground was called Elas, and they were savage bastards who crossed over. And then the Albanians, who had what they called the National Front, and they were fairly savage. Then they had miles and miles and miles of bloody partisans. So their return trip was not a picnic. There were many reasons to kill a German. One, because they didn't want him in their country. Two, he had a better firearm than the partisan did, a better jacket, better trousers, and above all, better boots. And they were so cunning that when they were going to kill a German, if they had a choice, they killed the older German rather than a youthful bloke deciding, because the older German had far better equipment than the younger blokes did coming towards the end of the war. But the thing they wanted was good boots, because it was very rough country to walk in, very rough. Beautiful to look at from the air, but if you are not looking at it, if you're trying to walk through it, it's a little different.
What was the feeling like knowing that the war was drawing to a close?
Well, everybody, I think, was pretty happy. Just once the war was over, people were going to stop shooting at you. And I think in itself was a big plus. I didn't realise later on that once the war stopped, the Air Force would demob you, because we were all known as HO, hostilities only. And of course my income would stop, and then I'd have to find a job. And that presented a problem, because I had a fairly poor education, and I really wasn't trained for anything. Wasn't trained for a thing.
We'll talk about that in a little while.
Yep.
During your time in Yugoslavia, you mentioned some of the jobs that you were involved with. What was the range of jobs, flying operations, that you were to be involved with?
Well, any partisan who came in and made a case for us to go and bomb something or damage something, they'd point to something in the map and they'd always say Tedeschi, 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 which means Germans. And usually blow up this or blow up that or blow up down a blow a bridge up, sink a ship, shoot, blow up a railway train. There was a group of Germans hiding just behind that tree, about 100 of them, go and put a rocket under their bunk, which we did. This is where the life of Biggles came in. And at that stage I had total control. It was up to me to talk over with Carl what we were going to do.
Can you describe to us what's involved in aiming at a target that's moving? Something like a train, for instance.
Well,
how do you knock out a train?
One rocket will do a train. It's a fantastic sight. Not too good for the blokes on board the train. The rocket was about 14 feet long, and it had a 65-pound explosive head on the front. The propellant was, I think, 9.5 feet of 4-inch cordite. And up here, next on the cockpit, next to the hood, there was a small aluminium plate of about 4 inches wide, 4 inches by 4 inches, and it had a little switch and a little knob. And the switch connected the electrical supply to the rocket rails, which are located under the main plane, and the knob could tell you whether you're going to fire 1, 2, 3, or 4. So it only burns for a few seconds, only about 6 or 7 seconds it burns, but we were told by one of our ballistic fellows that a rocket left the aircraft had been 1,750 and 1,800 miles an hour. There was no explosion, there was no backfire, or there's no recoil. You could just hear a very loud hiss over the Packard Merlin, which was working quite hard, because our attack plan was exactly 225 miles an hour, because every increase in speed or decrease in speed alters the angle of incidence on the wings. So you've got to know exactly where the angle of incidence is to avoid going too high or too low. And all you do, you line up on the target, aim at it, and get your speed to exactly 225, and as low as you could, then aim at it, and as soon as you press the button, swing off to the left or right as hard as you could go. So you never ever saw your own rockets hit the target. But every aircraft in those days had a cine camera in it, and the cine camera started from as soon as you pressed that button. So everybody but you saw your rocket strike. But I think it was only a few seconds before all the propellant burnt out. And after that, you've got a 14-foot steel tube with 65 pounds of high explosive, and it just falls to the ground. It goes off, of course, but it probably doesn't do the damage it would have done if you'd hit the target properly. That's why it was only 200 yards we had to fire at, because after that, the rocket couldn't maintain its flight. But it was quite good fun. As the Germans went further north, and we followed them, You'd walk into a village or a town or a port, basically. We did a lot of attacks on ships. And you'd see something, a ship or a building or something that you'd attacked. And it was quite awesome to see what one or two rockets would do, unbelievably damaging. And of course, the Germans, if they saw a hurricane coming towards them, they knew that they were rocket-firing hurricanes. We had no other hurricanes there. And they knew that there was a horrible English bastard sitting in the cockpit where he summoned a black button. And once the German stayed to watch that, when their bloke pressed the button, he had about six or seven seconds to live. It takes a fair amount of courage to just stand there and watch it. Mostly, what they would do, you could see them on the walls looking at you, hoping God you weren't going to turn in, and as soon as you made a left-hand turn like this and they realised they were the target, they'd go for their lives. Well, being hit with a 65-pound rocket is fairly destroying.
What was the feeling like when you could sort of play with the people on the ground like that?
Good fun. I was the bloke in the aeroplane. I was the bloke behind the guns and the rockets. Everything was going fine where I was.
What was the sense of power that you had in that situation?
I don't know that I ever thought it was a sense of power. We knew that they were quite frightened of us because I wouldn't like to be attacked by a rocket-firing aeroplane. But of course, the hurricane doesn't make too much noise when it's coming towards you. It can be quite close as long as it's coming towards you and you don't hear anything. It's only after it's gone over you and you get the effect of the exhaust that it's unbelievably noisy. But if you're 200 yards in front, a hurricane's only about that big, very small. And everyone is hoping, oh, it's not going to attack here, it's going to attack somebody on the road. And when they turn in, they say, oh, shit, we're in trouble. Run, boys. But it was quite good fun. We were there to incapacitate them before they got round to doing it to us. And when you're in the box seat, it feels very good.
You mentioned, obviously, the situation with the Wehrmacht Dunkirk situation in Tripoli.
It was Tunis,
yeah. Mm. And you've also mentioned blowing up ships where people, thousands of people in that situation, are killed. Mm. Was there ever a time when you came back from your flight and thought, what have I done? Or thought over some of the repercussions of...
We were there to do what we've been trained to do, what we were sent there to do. That's why they gave us a very smart blue uniform. Every 14 days, a very small amount of money and a small amount of food from time to time. That's what we were there for. That was our prime role.
Being a flight commander, you're obviously controlling the lives of other airmen. How did that affect you?
Didn't worry me at all. I mean, all the blokes in my flight just thought about the situation as I did. We were there to do a job, and today we do something, and tomorrow we do something else, and the next day we do something else, and the next day we do something else. But it all involves flying hurricanes and putting bloody big rockets under German backsides.
What was the feeling like in relation to controlling what these chaps were going to be doing from one day to the next?
No problem. You just say, fellas, tomorrow morning we're going to so-and-so. We'll be taking off about so-and-so. We'll have four rockets. Or if it was a very important target, we might have eight rockets. We'll have four rockets and an LRT, long-range tank.
What sense of responsibility that one had at that situation, given your position?
Well, it was just something you had to do. That's what you were there for. It didn't worry me. If somebody had attacked me with a rocket, I may have had a different view.
But given the fact that you're a flight commander, say, for instance, one of your airmen, your pilots didn't return, what was your duty then?
Somebody, usually a local bishop, would have to write a letter to the parents of this chap and would have to try and say in a pleasant way that their son had just been killed Nobody went into great detail of how. It just said, in an operation so-and-so-and-so attack, your son was unfortunately killed. That's about all you could say to them. That I would have found quite difficult, but usually you'd have the adjutant would do it, or one of the adjutant's staff would do it, or the local parson would do it.
Could you describe to us the sort of briefings that you would give?
Quite simple. Everybody would get into the operations room, and I'd say, we're going to today to so-and-so and so-and-so. There's a ship, or there's a train, or there's a few tanks, or there's a platoon, or a brigade of Germans, and we're going to give it a little bit of curry. We take it off at 1300 hours. We should be back with luck about 1445. Any questions? Of course there are. That's all, fellas. Don't be late for takeoff. And everyone would turn up, baggers on, get into the Hurricane, start it up, you press those two buttons and that beautiful Rolls Royce Merlin go, poh, a sound to die for.